Okay, so I want to talk about two methodological criticisms that Friedman makes of the Austrian approach. And I'll spend a short amount of time on one of them and most of my time on the other. But I think that in a way, both criticisms may be rooted in the same misunderstanding. All right, so first of all, Friedman has a famous criticism of the a priori method of praxeology. And what Friedman famously says is, look, if you're going to have an a priori methodology where you figure out, simply by reasoning, certain truths about economics, then the problem is that if you and I have a disagreement in economic theory, well, I just consult, you know, my reasoning and you consult your reasoning, and if my reasoning leads me to one thing and your reasoning leads you to another, there's no way for us to resolve our dispute. And that's as he famously says, you know, the only thing that they could do is fight. Or as he puts it at one point, you know, our only options are either to, you know, we can try to find a logical flaw in the other's argument, but in the end we have no way to resolve it except by fighting. Which seems to suggest that the approach of trying to find a logical flaw in the other side's argument is somehow an ineffective way of doing it. Whereas he says, if instead you take a more empirical approach, where you say, well, here's what would count as an empirical refutation of my view, sort of in the Popperian line, and then if you can both agree on what would count as empirical evidence one way or the other, then you can go and look at for empirical evidence, and that way you have a way of settling disputes. So the idea is that empirical economists have a way of settling disputes that praxeologists don't, and the praxeologists are inevitably going to have to resort to force. Now, I can say something about that. Right off. I'll say more about it, you know, toward the end. But right off, notice, for example, that no one makes the same criticism of mathematics. If two mathematicians disagree, no one assumes that unless they can find some empirical resolution, they have to fight it out. It seems as though there is granted that what he calls trying to find a logical flaw in the other person's position, you know, seems like exactly what you would do. I think one thing we think is going on here, and I'll come back to this later, but one thing that's going on here is that Friedman thinks, seems to be thinking of a priori reasoning as a matter of something like turning to a private inner voice in your head, or turning to some kind of feeling of psychological certainty, and using that as your as your reason for claiming something. And so if I turn my mental eyes inward and stare at some proposition and I feel some sense of certainty that it's true, and you turn your mental eyes inward and you stare at the same proposition and you feel some kind of psychological certainty that it's false, then it seems hard to see how we could, you know, get any farther in communication. But that suggests that Friedman has a psychological conception of self-evidence, that to be self-evident is to produce a feeling of certainty in you when you contemplate a proposition, a feeling that perhaps could be reproduced by giving you the appropriate kind of medication. Whereas self-evidence is supposed to be a logical claim. To say that something is self-evident is supposed to mean that it doesn't need any evidence beyond itself. And those of you who were at David Gordon's lecture the other day may recall his saying that, strictly speaking, if you thought of your evidence for a proposition as being your feeling of psychological certainty when you contemplated it, then that wouldn't really be self-evidence. You wouldn't say that your evidence was the statement itself. Your evidence would instead be some feeling of confidence you had in thinking about it. Also notice that Mises seems to have precisely the opposite view. If you look at the quotation from Mises, as the second quotation in section one, Mises thinks that, far from thinking as Friedman does, that praxeology leaves you with disputes that can't be resolved unless you turn to the empirical evidence. Mises thinks that it's the empirical evidence that creates disputes that can't be resolved unless you turn to praxeology, because empirical evidence needs to be interpreted. And just staring at the empirical evidence without an interpretation of it isn't going to get you anywhere. Okay, so that's Friedman's first criticism, as criticism of Austrian a priorism, and I will come back to that at the end. I want to now talk about the second criticism. This is a criticism that Friedman doesn't explicitly make of Austrians, but he makes it of a certain position that Austrians, in fact, hold. So, for example, Austrians often criticize neoclassical economists for having idealized or unrealistic models or descriptions of the economy. Think, for example, of Austrian criticisms of the perfect competition model, where everyone has perfect information and there are infinitely many producers, and information about price discrepancies travels instantaneously through the economy and so on. Austrians often criticize these things. Friedman isn't explicitly responding to Austrians here, but he is responding to criticisms of economic theories for not being realistic. And Friedman's going to argue there's nothing wrong with a theory being unrealistic, that in fact it should be and has to be unrealistic. And this is an argument he gives in his book, Essays in Positive Economics, which Hayek incidentally described as being in its way as dangerous as Keynes's general theory. Hayek famously used to say, I regret that because I was sort of both a friend and a political ally in certain respects of Keynes on the issue of fighting inflation, I didn't attack his book, The General Theory, as much as I should have. Also because I thought he was probably just going to change his mind again in a few years anyway, and it wasn't worth it. But in retrospect, I regret not attacking Keynes. Well, here he says, for similar reasons, I was both a friend and a much more political ally of Milton Friedman, and so I never attacked that book, but I really should have. All right, so there's this quote. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there's this long quote from Friedman that comes next on the handout. We're essentially saying this. He's saying, look, you may criticize economists for using unrealistic assumptions, but what would be the alternative? What would be a fully realistic way of doing economics? Well, for example, then, if you're trying to understand, the grain market, you'd have to describe everything about the people who are buying and selling and producing grain. You'd have to describe how many freckles they have on their left wrist and, what they had for dinner and what shoes they're wearing and so forth. And, many of these things just aren't going to be relevant. They're not going to be relevant for what matters, which is prediction. If you want to predict what's going to happen to the economy, how many freckles someone has on their left wrist is not going to really affect things. And so what we need is something that's useful for predicting. It's not necessarily going to be accurate. It's going to be stylized. He says, well, it's just like geometry. In geometry, everyone knows that there aren't really such things as lines and points and planes in reality. There are no perfectly flat surfaces or perfectly thin lines in reality. So geometry doesn't describe reality. But nevertheless, we can use geometry to describe and predict reality. And so in the same way, the purpose of a model in economics is not to reflect the way reality really is. It's to be good at making predictions. And so therefore, the criticism of economic models for being unrealistic is irrelevant. If a model makes a good prediction, then it is, then it's going to be perfectly good. And being realistic would mean containing, all the detail, including all the massive irrelevant detail, which is impossible, and even if it were possible, wouldn't be especially desirable. Now, there are several points one could worry about here. First of all, one thing to recognize is that when Friedman talks about what's needed to explain something, and when Austrians talk about what's needed to explain something, they don't mean quite the same thing. When Friedman talks about economic explanation, he has in mind prediction. To explain something is to be able to predict under what circumstances it would occur. And this isn't, this is much more narrow than what Austrians mean by explanation. There's a famous line that I would have put on the handout, except that it would have required a fifth page, and surely four is enough. But the famous quote from Ludwig Lachmann says, the the function of economics, the purpose of economics, is to make the world around us, the social world around us, intelligible in terms of the pursuit of plans, and also to trace the unintended consequences of those plans. We'll take the first half of it. So you want to understand the world around you in terms of human action, human plans, human purposes. That's not just the same thing as making predictions. And I have a little quote from the philosopher Peter Winch here at the bottom, where he says, you know, being able to predict something and being able to explain it aren't the same thing. Suppose that you have the ability to predict with high accuracy the statistical occurrences of certain words in Chinese. You know, so if you're listening to someone speaking Chinese, you've studied statistical occurrences of words in Chinese language long enough to know that, you know, it's 78% likely that this person will use such and such a word, you know, will make such and such a sound in the next 5 minutes or something like that. But you could know that without having any idea what he's talking about. So the ability to understand the meaning of something is not the same as being able to predict, you know, the likelihood of its occurrence. Also, and here's a point that Mises frequently makes, even if you are good at predicting something empirically, unless you understand the reasons behind it, you won't know for how, you know, you won't know how long you can trust that regularity to last. There are various regularities that last for a while and then they stop. And, you know, they're not natural laws or anything. They're just things that happen for a while and then they stop. And unless you understand what's behind them, you won't be able to really understand what's going on. You know, so, for example, suppose that in 2001 I had formulated the following theory, that there is a constant Tolkienian force in the universe that produces a Tolkien movie once a year. And someone could say, well, that's unrealistic. There's no Tolkienian force in the universe. I said, yeah, but look, it doesn't have to be realistic. All it has to do is be a good predictor. So look, and surfing, 2001, bang, a Tolkien movie comes out. 2002, another Tolkien movie comes out. 2003, a third Tolkien movie comes out. And people say, look, my theory, you know, you might want to talk about like the purposes and intentions and beliefs and desires of the people involved, but look, all I need, my constant Tolkienian force may not be realistic, but it's a good predictor. But then comes the next year, no Tolkien movie. And if I've been relying on this model, I'll be all surprised. Whereas people who were trying to understand the Tolkien movies in terms of the beliefs and desires of the people involved will not be surprised, because they'll understand that this was a three-part movie adaptation of a three-part book. And for that reason, when you find a regularity, unless you understand the regularity in terms of, you know, the reasons and purposes of people behind it, you won't know whether to expect this regularity to last or not. Now, Mises, as we'll see, Mises and Friedman aren't directly talking to each other here, but Mises, we can see in this next passage at the top of page 2, is criticizing something like Friedman's approach. Mises talks about the classical economists, although he also thinks that his own teacher, Boehm Bawerk, was to some extent guilty of this as well, that they took economics to be about a, to some extent, idealized or stylized conception of human action, one that focused purely on monetary motives, for example. And they said, well, look, this doesn't really apply to all action, but applies to, you might say, the business side of action, or actions to the extent that they represent business interests and so on. And, you know, they weren't quite as extreme as Friedman was, because they tended to think, well, these are at least, you know, roughly approximately true of many kinds of actions in the economy, whereas Friedman doesn't even think they have to be approximately true. All that matters is they're being good predictors. So the classical economists, and likewise, you know, some of his Austrian predecessors that Mises criticizes here, he's not saying that they're as far from him as Friedman would be. But he does argue that economics shouldn't be about idealized or stylized actions. It should be trying to explain actual human actions with all the complexity of their motives. And also the next quote from Mises here, he's criticizing Max Weber's idea that economics studies ideal types and things like, you know, the entrepreneur and buyers and sellers and workers and so forth are idealized types, which is, you know, something like caricatures. They're one-sided intensification of some aspect. So, you know, take some aspects of something and blow it up to make it like the major feature of that thing. And, you know, that's the way you, that's the way you do caricatures. If you want to do a successful caricature of someone, take some distinctive feature of theirs and then, you know, exaggerate it. So if someone has, you know, slightly larger nose or slightly smaller eyes than usual, then you make their nose huge, or then you make their eyes really tiny. That's how you, you know, make caricatures. And, you know, they can be useful for helping you identify something or recognize it. During World War II, the psychologist James J. Gibson taught American pilots how to recognize enemy planes from friendly ones by drawing cartoons that exaggerated the features of the planes. So they can be useful for various purposes. But Mises says, look, you know, praxeology is not about having stylized, exaggerated, or one-sided models. The concepts in praxeology are supposed to apply with literal truth and accuracy to the phenomena they're trying to explain. Okay, this is the point where I want to bring in the Aristotelian tradition about abstraction. So in ancient Greece, there was this big debate about whether abstraction falsifies. What do I mean by that? Well, what's an abstraction? An abstraction is when you form a concept that leaves out, you know, some details. So, for example, you've got these pens here. And this one has a blue cap. These two have red cap and a green cap. But I could form just a general concept of pen that leaves out the fact they have different colors. And so I just don't mention the different colors. And so I'd have a general concept of pen that applies to all of them, as opposed to something more concrete that would specify the individual differences among the pens. I come up with sort of an abstract conception of pen. It doesn't include the color of the cap, and so that applies equally to all of them. There was a big dispute among Greek philosophers as to whether abstraction falsifies what it's talking about. In other words, the dispute was, look, you come up with this generic concept of pen that applies to all three of these pens equally, but in fact they're all different, and you're treating them as all alike. They have all different, you know, just calling them pen and having this one category of pen that you apply to all of them, you are somehow leaving out the particularity and concreteness of their differences and just treating them as all alike. Isn't that false to what reality is like? And doesn't that mean that, you know, there's something, that abstraction is something we should be skeptical of, you know, which is a view that became very popular in the 19th and early 20th centuries. You find lots of philosophers talking about how abstraction is always in some way falsifying reality. Well, Plato and Aristotle had different responses to this worry. Plato's response was to say, it's true that abstractions don't really apply properly and strictly to empirical physical reality, but they are true of some other reality. They're true of some kind of higher immaterial realm of perfect essences. So, you know, in geometry, for example, there really are perfectly flat planes and perfectly thin, you know, infinitely thin lines and so forth, but not in physical reality. In physical reality, all surfaces are bumpy and all lines have some thickness and so forth. But geometry isn't about empirical reality. It's about the geometrical realm. And, and there are various ways of applying those concepts to empirical reality, but they don't apply perfectly. And in general, you know, nothing in the physical world is a complete and perfect exemplification of the corresponding abstraction. But abstraction doesn't falsify. It's true. It's just not true of the empirical world perfectly. It's true of the Platonic realm of ideas. And, you know, it's only imperfectly and by way of approximation, although certainly usefully, that it can be applied to empirical reality. Aristotle has exactly the opposite view. Aristotle thought that abstractions apply perfectly to reality. In fact, he thought this included geometry. He thought that planes and lines apply to reality, but not in the way that Plato had thought they would have to do if they applied. What Aristotle thought was that in Well, here's what he said, for example, about geometry. He said, geometry is about physical objects, but it doesn't treat them as physical. It leaves aside their physicality. And likewise, in dealing with them as, you know, having flat surfaces, it leaves aside the deviations from flatness, the bumpiness. It just considers, you know, or in considering a point, it just considers something in terms of its location while leaving aside its extension. But it's not actually saying that the thing has no size. It's simply leaving out the size. Just as if I talk about pens, I'm not actually, if I form a general concept of pen that applies to all three of these, I'm not forming the concept of a pen that has a cap of no color or that fails to have a color for its cap or something like that. I'm simply not specifying what the color is. And this then gave rise to a distinction in the Aristotelian tradition that's sometimes called the distinction between precisive and non-precisive abstraction. Precisive abstraction is when I form a concept of something as not having a certain property. You know, I'm forming an idea of something that just does not have a certain property that in reality it has. Whereas a non-precisive abstraction, I'm simply failing to mention it. So, for example, take these pens again. If I formed a precisive abstraction of these pens, what I'd do is I'd be thinking of a stylized or idealized pen, one whose cap had no particular color. Therefore, something that would be physically impossible in reality. So a precisive abstraction of these pens would be, you know, a pen that has only the properties these pens all share and simply doesn't have any color for its cap. Now, obviously, that concept would be falsifying. It might be useful for some purpose or other, but it wouldn't be an accurate depiction of these pens. A non-precisive abstraction would be an abstraction that that thinks about the properties these pens have in common that makes them pens, but simply doesn't say anything about the color. It doesn't say that it has no color. It just doesn't say what the color is. You would simply be leaving that information blank. You know, so for example, suppose I were to describe someone's body and leave out what their head looked like. So I'd say everything about, the measurements of the body and the skin color and how muscular they were and so forth, but I would just say nothing about the head. That's not the same thing as describing a headless person, as saying that they have no head. If I were to describe the person as having no head, that would be a precisive abstraction. I would be specifying the absence of something that's actually present. But if I simply describe the body without mentioning what the head's like, then, you know, that might be useful or not useful depending on your purposes, but it wouldn't be the same as saying the person has no head. I wouldn't be specifying the absence of a head. There'd be an absence of specifying the head. You know, there's a difference between saying that something is absent and simply not saying anything about its being present. And so in the Aristotelian tradition here, I have quotes from Thomas Aquinas and Franz Brentano and Ayn Rand, to pick three rather different Aristotelians, but who all have something like this distinction in common. I also throw in Charles Comte, who isn't especially an Aristotelian, but he's a 19th century French liberal and one of the people on the line between Jean-Baptiste Say and Bastiat and Molinari, so he's a proto-Austrian in some ways. And I'm not going to read all these quotes, but you can look through them and you'll see they're all making this distinction. They don't all use the same terminology, but they're all saying, look, there's a difference between abstractions that leave out information and abstractions that actually pretend the information's not there. And once you see that distinction, you can see how Mises would want to reply to Friedman. Because I think that Mises is implicitly making this distinction when he talks about Weber and when he says, you know, look, these praxeological concepts are not ideal types. Ideal types are in a sense, Weber's ideal types, at least as Mises is interpreting them, are something like what I'm calling precisive abstractions. An idealized type of an entrepreneur might be someone who, there's just nothing to him but entrepreneurialness, and he never does anything that's not entrepreneurial. Whereas that's not the concept that that Mises has in mind, and Mises' abstractions are non-precisive. So when Friedman says that in order for an economic description to be realistic, it would have to specify everything down to the eye color and the middle names of the grain traders and so forth. He's assuming that in order for it to be fully realistic, it would have to specify the presence of everything that's present. But in fact, you know, all that in order for it to be realistic, all it has to do is not say anything false. There's a difference between not saying anything false and saying everything that's true to say. You know, for example, there are various descriptions I could give of this room. I could say that there are lots of tables and chairs in this room. I could simply, you know, fail to mention any of you. But if that's different from saying there are no people in the room. If I said this room has tables and chairs in it but no people, that would be false. But if I just say the room has tables and chairs in it, that would be true. It would be leaving out something. How important the thing is I'm leaving out would, you know, would depend on what someone's interests were, what they wanted to know about the room. You know, and of course, you know, one thing that you know, that Austrians often criticize about neoclassical models is that the information they leave out is the very information that Austrians think you need to, you know, need to appeal to explain things. So, for example, since Austrians think that asymmetries in information are crucial to understanding arbitrage and entrepreneurial opportunities and equilibration and so forth, therefore, any model of the economy that leaves out asymmetries of information, even if it were, you know, not specifying their absence, but merely failing to specify their presence, wouldn't be very useful. But at least if all it did was just fail to specify their presence, it wouldn't be false. It's false if it actually specifies their absence. So there's a difference between how detailed something is and how realistic it is. I mean, saying that something is a Saint Bernard is more realistic, is more detailed than saying it's a dog, which in turn is more detailed than saying it's a mammal, which is more, in turn is more detailed than saying it's a physical object. But saying it's a Saint Bernard isn't any more realistic than saying that it's a dog. Saying it's a dog isn't any more realistic than saying it's a mammal or saying it's a physical object. They're all equally realistic. They're all equally true. It's just that one of them has more information than the other. Whereas if I wanted to idealize, you know, if in order to study the dog's mass and the forces on it, I decided to idealize the dog by treating the dog as, you know, spherical, which might be useful for as approximation for certain purposes if I want to do something in physics or something. But that would be, at least be falsifying. Now, falsifying abstractions can be useful for various purposes, but they wouldn't be an accurate description of the dog. I would be falsifying what the dog is like if I treated the dog as a homogeneous sphere. But if I just say the dog is a physical object, I don't say what shape it is. That's not, you know, that's not false and that's not unrealistic. Now, someone might say, well, look, doesn't Austrian economics sometimes use unrealistic or stylized models? What about the evenly rotating economy? Isn't that an idealized or stylized model? Sure, but it's not supposed to be a realistic description of the economy. In fact, the whole point of the evenly rotating economy is that it's a is to show how it's different from, you know, the real world. Sometimes dealing with a stylized or simplified model can be useful. For example, in the real world, the difference between profit and interest can be kind of murky. For, you know, it's not obvious instantly what the difference is. You know, you do something, you get some money back. Is that profit? Is it interest? Is it some of each? We might not have a clear grasp on those concepts. The evenly rotating economy is useful because it allows us to imagine a circumstance where there would be interest but no profit, and then as a result, it helps us distinguish between the two. You know, wanting to be a realist in economics doesn't mean you think that there's no useful purpose for stylized or idealized models. But nevertheless, the praxeological concepts aren't supposed to be stylized or idealized. They're supposed to really apply to the real world. Okay, so now what I want to suggest is that both Friedman's mistake about realism and abstraction and his mistake about a priorism are expressions of psychologism. What's psychologism? Well, this is a term that seems to have been coined, as far as I can tell, by the late 19th, early 20th century German logician Gottlob Frege, who may possibly have had some indirect influence on Mises. At any rate, he influenced Husserl, and Mises cites Husserl's critique of psychologism. Basically, Husserl wrote a book. Frege attacked it for being psychologistic. Husserl, at least on my interpretation, back down. There's some Husserl fans who think, no, he never backed down. But as I interpret him, Husserl backed down and then accepted a lot of what Frege had to say. And then that stuff, the stuff that's influenced by Frege, Mises, you know, goes on to cite in the Human Action. So I think that Frege may have influenced Mises indirectly. I don't know of any evidence that he influenced him directly. So psychologism is the mistake of confusing logical relationships with psychological ones, or of trying to reduce psychology to logic. For example, in the 19th century, there were a lot of people who suggested that logic could be reduced to general laws of human psychology. So, for example, to say that one proposition logically entails another is really to say something like, the human mind is so constituted that when you think of proposition A, it just tends to cause you to think of proposition B next. And, you know, Frege made fun of this. He was great at making fun of things. He said that, you know, this would be unable to distinguish between good reasoning and bad reasoning. Because, you know, it might be that, you know, thinking one thing might cause you to think of another thing, even if that other thing doesn't follow at all. It just reminds you of it or something like that. Frege drew a distinction between what he called the outer realm, the inner realm, and the third realm. So I've drawn this this diagram here. So he says, well, for any, you know, anything we think about, there are two questions you could ask about it. One is it sensible or nonsensible? In other words, is it capable of being perceived by the senses? You know, it's a sort of an object in physical reality that we can interact with through our senses and know it that way. Or is it not perceivable by the senses? And the other question is it private or public? Or as he put it, is it owned or unowned? But I think that, especially among libertarians, that might be a misleading way of putting it, because, you know, by owned, he means something that's sort of accessible to, in knowledge to only one person. So since we can all see this pen would be unowned in his sense. And since this pen certainly is not unowned in our sense, I think it would be a little misleading to use that term. So I'm going to say private and public. That could be misunderstood too, but I think not quite as easily. So this pen is a public object. You know, it's not something that only I can know. We can all be aware of it. And it's also a sensible object. That is, we are all aware of it through our senses. Now, there are things that are private and nonsensible. You know, so, for example, my private thoughts, you know, what I'm thinking right now, you know, as opposed to what I'm saying, what I'm really thinking, you don't know. Only I can know that. So Frege said, actually. Some philosophers would dispute that, but never mind. Sufficient complication for now. So Frege thought, you know, you can't perceive my thoughts. You can perceive my face and hear my words and try to guess at my thoughts, but you can't actually directly perceive my thoughts, my inner feelings. So they're not sensible. They're not perceivable through the senses. And they're private, you know. They exist, in some sense, they're an aspect of me. They're an aspect of my consciousness. They're not accessible to your consciousness. They're, you know, internal to me. But Frege said, there is a third kind of thing, something that's public but nonsensible. And these are things having to do with logic and with conceptual content and so forth. So here's a way of understanding what he has in mind. Suppose that I'm thinking that Paris is the capital of France, and you're also thinking that Paris is the capital of France. Are we thinking the same thing? Are we having the same thought? Well, what Frege wants to say is that's ambiguous. If by the same thought you mean the same mental process or the same mental image or the same mental activity or whatever you think of, you know, thinking is, then we don't have the same. You know, my thinking that Paris is the capital of France is a mental process going on in my mind, and you're thinking it is a mental process going on in your mind. So in that sense, we're not all thinking the same thing. But the content is the same. You know, it's not as though I'm thinking about my own private Paris, and you've got your own private Paris, and I can't refer to yours, and you can't refer to mine. We're talking about the same thing. So if by the idea or the thought you mean the mental process, then that's private. I have mine, you have yours. But if you mean the content of what's being thought, then that's open and accessible to everyone. And he decided to use idea for the private thing and thought for the public thing. But, you know, you don't have to follow that particular terminology. That was just his choice. So the point is that that the realm of abstract contents, the realm of concepts and propositions, and thus of logic and mathematics, that all that is public. I think it's interesting that Frege's three categories, the inner realm, the realm of, you know, the private inner psychological experience, the outer realm of perceivable physical stuff, and the third realm of logic and concepts, corresponds nicely with Mises' three terms. Mises says that when people use the term psychology, sometimes they mean one thing, sometimes it means another. And in this quote at the bottom of page 3, going on to the top of page 4, I just talk about how Mises distinguishes three different things you might think of as psychology. So there's naturalistic psychology, which is concerned with those aspects of human action that you could simply, pick up on without any kind of understanding of its meaning. So, you know, stuff like, you know, my facial expressions or my muscular twitches or the neurons firing in my head, stuff like that. Then there's what he called thymology, which is an understanding of the subjectivity of thought of the person, understanding, you know, how things seem to them. And there's praxeology, which deals with, you know, the abstract character of the concept of human action itself. And he says people tend to run these three things together, and he thinks they're distinct. Positivists tend to confuse thymology with naturalistic psychology. Historicists tend to confuse thymology with praxeology. And Mises thinks, you know, there are these three different things, and I think they interestingly correspond to Frege's three realms. Okay, what does this have to do with Friedman? Well, if you conflate the logical realm with the inner psychological realm, if you conflate what Frege calls the third realm with the inner realm, then in effect you're confusing the act of thinking with the content of thinking. So, for example, if you say, well, you know, my thinking that Paris is the capital of France is something that happens in my mind, you're thinking that Paris is the capital of France is something that happens in your mind, and therefore we must be thinking different things, you'd be confusing the act of thinking, which is separate. I have my act of thinking, you have yours, with the content of thinking, which is the same. So psychologism, since it tends to understand, you know, psychology in terms of logic and abstract propositional content in terms simply of psychological dispositions, it is prone to confuse the act of thinking with the content of thinking. Now, let's entertain the hypothesis. We can treat this as an empirical hypothesis, you know, make Friedman happy temporarily. We can entertain the hypothesis that Friedman is falling subject to psychologism. If that's true, let's see whether that would explain the criticisms he makes. So how would that affect the way you think about abstraction? Well, when you form an abstraction, like when I think about, you know, I look at these three pens and I form the general concept of pen, and I leave out, in forming a general concept of pen, I leave out what color the cap is. In doing that, then, the color of the cap is absent from my act of thinking. Suppose you've confused the act of thinking with the content of thinking, the content of the thought. Then you have to think that if the color of the cap is absent from my act of thinking, then I must be thinking of a pen that has no color for its cap. And so therefore, I would tend to think that all abstraction is precisive. I tend to think that if I form an abstraction, I am thinking of some imaginary weird thing that couldn't exist in physical reality. If you think that, then of course you're going to think that abstraction always falsifies, and therefore that it would be crazy to criticize an abstraction for being unrealistic, since they're always going to be false. And they may be useful for various purposes, prediction and so on, but they can never be accurate. Whereas if you distinguish the act from the content of thinking, then you can think, well, I can be failing to think about the color of the pen's cap. That could could be absent from my thought without my thereby attributing that absence to the thing I'm thinking of and thinking that it somehow has, you know, no color for its cap. Instead, you could say, well, I'm thinking of a pen that must have some color for its cap or other, but not necessarily, you know, but yeah, I'm not specifying which color it is, and so it could apply equally well to any cap. So I'm not thinking about some abstract platonic cap that's colorless. I'm thinking of something that applies with complete accuracy to every actual pen, no matter what color it is. So if Friedman is falling into psychologism, that would explain why he doesn't see the distinction between precisive and non-precisive abstraction. I think it might also explain his rejection of Austrian a priorism. Remember, he thinks of a priorism as a matter of turning to kind of an inner voice in your head, a kind of internal psychological experience. But if we think of logic and mathematics and praxeology and things like that as third realm rather than inner realm items, then they're public, just as mathematics is public. You know, if two mathematicians have a dispute, it's not an empirical dispute. It's not something you could settle by going out and, measuring physical objects or something like that. But it's a public dispute. Mathematics is public. You know, you can show me what your reasoning is, and I can point you out. Well, look, at step three, you seem to have confused this with that, and so forth. You know, we can go write it up on the blackboard. Although what we're arguing about isn't those marks of chalk on the board. We're talking about what they stand for. But we're perfectly well capable of both grasping the same reality. Logic is public. Mathematics is public. Praxeology is public that way too. And so it's but if you don't see the difference between logic and psychology, between the third realm and the inner realm, between the act of thinking and the content of thinking, then you're going to think that because the act of thinking is private, then some of the content of thinking is private, and the only thing that's public is the empirical, physical world. And so you're going to think that unless you're dealing with something empirical, you're going to be retreating to something private. Now, finally, I want to close by suggesting that the mistake that Friedman makes about economic methodology is possibly one that Mises is guilty of when it comes to ethics. So look at the very last quote on the last page of the handout. This is a quote where Mises says that those people who believe in objective ethics are in effect listening to internal intuitions. And he says it's, on their view, cognition of justice is imparted to man by inner voice, paying no attention to the fact that people can and really do disagree with regard to the interpretation of the inner voice, and that no method of peacefully settling such disagreements can be found, since there's no rational means available for either endorsing or rejecting a doctrine suggested by an inner voice. Well, notice how much that sounds like Friedman's criticism of praxeology. Yes, Friedman says at the beginning that if we're if we're both appealing to a priori information, then we have no way to resolve it except by fighting. Here Mises says, if we're appealing to these inner ethical intuitions, there is no peaceful way of settling such disagreements. So I suspect that Mises may be thinking that if you think there's an objective ethics, then you have to be thinking of it as a matter of listening to an inner voice, some kind of inner psychological voice providing you with intuitions, and that other people are getting different intuitions. So I just want to close with the suggestion that maybe someone could try to rescue objective ethics from Mises' criticism here in something like the same way that Mises wants to rescue a priori economics from Friedman's criticism. Again, I'm making it sound as though Mises and Friedman are responding directly to each other here, and they're not, but I mean, I think analogously so. Okay, questions? Yes. Yeah, it's interesting that Friedman doesn't say much about mathematics. I mean, because, you know, the question is, why doesn't his criticism of praxeology, why does he not think this applies to mathematics too? Because Friedman isn't, doesn't have that view of mathematics. In fact, no one could accuse mainstream neoclassical economics of having too little faith in mathematics. I think there's a tendency to think, well, that some of mathematics is the only realm of the a priori that nothing else could be. But he doesn't really address that. There's a cartoon I'm fond of two professors at a blackboard, and one of them is advancing to on the other, shaking his fist, saying, "You want proof? I'll give you proof." But it's interesting how seldom that actually happens. Not never, but seldom. Yeah.
Given your work in Wittgenstein,
I think in order to adequately answer that, I'd have to take more time than we have to answer this particular point about Wittgenstein and rule following. Here's sort of the brief worry. So suppose you tell someone, add 2 each time. And so they go and they write 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. And so you think, aha, they've understood what I said. But suppose that when they get to 1,000, they suddenly switch to 1,004, 1,008, and so on. They start doing what you would call adding 4 each time. But they say, no, this is just what you said to do. And so part of the point is that you can, there's no finite sequence of actions that would ever settle which possible rule they're following. Now, I don't think that Wittgenstein intended this as a skeptical point. I think that what strikes Wittgenstein is not, that we can't know what rules people are following, but that we can. We seldom have any trouble figuring out what rules other people are following. Why is that? It can't be for this purely behavioristic reason. As for what I think is going on there, I don't have time to explain it now, but I have an article called Rule Following, Praxeology, and Anarchy that's online. So if you search for that sequence of words, you will get me. And I say a little bit of what I think is going on there. But I think that what Wittgenstein wants to say is somewhat relevant to what Mises calls themology, which is this ability to understand what other people are thinking. Because after all, although we might call what people are thinking private, it's not really private in the sense that we just cannot know what other people are thinking. We do know. Now, Wittgenstein thinks our ability to know what other people are thinking depends on their being like us in a certain way, which is a point that Hayek makes too. If we met some extraterrestrials, we might have a harder time figuring what they're thinking. And as I see it, the moral of this rule-following paradox is not, oh, we can never be sure of what other people are thinking, but rather our ability to be sure that what other people are thinking can't just be something that that is logically entailed by some physicalistic description of the motions they're making at the blackboard or whatever. Yes. I don't know. I know that. I mean, I'd be curious to know what Mises thought about. Did Mises ever read Power and Market? I don't know. I don't know And when was Power and Market published? And Mises died in what, 72, was it? See, 73. So, although the manuscript, he might have possibly seen the manuscript of Power and Market before that, because at least a version of that was supposed to be Man, Economy, and State originally. Now, what Rothbard does in Power and Market, and I'm thinking particularly of the last section of Power and Market, the stuff on the praxeological critique of anti-market ethics, what he's doing there is not, you know, it's not the same as what Hoppe's doing, but it is offering a praxeological way of criticizing certain ethical claims. If you can show by praxeological means that a certain ethical goal is either incoherent or impossible to achieve, that counts as a reason to reject it. That is, you know, it's purely praxeology based. And of course, Rothbard thought that this is sort of an extension of what Mises was doing anyway. But he puts it as a way of criticizing ethics praxeologically in a way that Mises is less likely to. But I just wonder what he would have thought of that. I don't know. I don't know if he did think something particular about that or if he was aware of it. Yeah. Yes. Well, I don't know that much about Fritsch. I know that there's a lot of dispute about the extent to which Mises' view is like Kant's or not. And part of this is a matter of disputing exactly what do you take Mises' view to be and exactly what do you take Kant's view to be. There's a distinction that's sometimes drawn. I think it may be Barry Smith who comes up with this terminology, between reflectionism and impositionism. So reflectionism is that praxeological truth is somewhere out there in the world, and or conceptual truths in general are out there in reality in some way, and we just open our minds to it, and you know, we find out by, you know, in some way or other. Whereas impositionism is a view that conceptual categories are somewhat inherent in our minds, and we sort of impose them on our experience, like, you know, to use a famous analogy from Bertrand Russell, it's like having blue spectacles glued to your head so that everything you see looks blue because, you know, your experience is being shaped and structured by something that's internal to you. And so part of the question, you know, so there's a question of A, is Kant an impositionist? Does Kant think that in experiencing the world where our mind is imposing some kind of structure on it, whether that's the right or wrong interpretation of Kant? Then there's also the question, is that the right or wrong interpretation of Mises? I think both those questions are complicated to answer because in some ways when it's often the case that there's no quite true answer to the question, which thing did a philosopher mean? Because often they were sort of in the process of trying to work it out and think it out, and they sometimes slide into this way of thinking about it, sometimes slide into that way of thinking about it, or they're trying to navigate between two different ways of thinking about it, and sometimes, you know. So in with the case of Kant, for example, I think that Kant is often doing two different things at once without sometimes recognizing it. On my own view of impositionism and reflectionism, I think that those are both, you know, wrong views, that we shouldn't think of conceptual categories either as something the world imposes on our minds or something that our minds impose on the world. But as for Fritsch, I just don't know enough about Fritsch to say anything useful about that. Yes. Well, so here's the way to describe the alternative is to explain what I think is wrong with the first two. So, if you say that logic or praxeological categories or whatever are something that our mind imposes on the world, then that implies that, but for our mind doing that, the world might be different. You know, that, you know, might not be logical or whatever. Likewise, if you think of logical categories are something the world imposes on our minds, then that implies that but for the world doing that, our minds might be different, might be illogical. But if, in fact, we can't conceive of an illogical mind or an illogical world, then then we can't make sense of something that needs to have logical categories imposed on it in either direction, because nothing could even be without being subject to logical categories. The mind, nothing would count as thought without being subject to logical categories. Nothing would count as action without being subject to it. Nothing would count as physical reality without being subject to it. And so therefore, the logicality of thought and the logicality of action aren't things where one is somehow the explanation of the other. They just have to be two sides of the same fact, that logical coherence is sort of bedrock. And there's always a temptation to want to ground it in something else. I mean, psychologism is the idea that you want to ground logic in psychology. Then, you know, with Platonism is the view you want to ground logic in the nature of some sort of metaphysical entities. But from my perspective, those are both mistakes. Logic isn't something you can ground on anything else, because the whole notion of grounding things presupposes logic to begin with. Yes? I don't know enough about it. Yes?
How can you explain Mises' realism, given that he's a Kantian a priori? I mean, how do you consolidate his view of an objective reality that we can have knowledge about?
Again, it depends exactly what's involved in being a Kantian a priorist. I mean, when Kant says that we know only appearances, not things in themselves, there's a frequent tendency to interpret that as meaning there are two kinds of things. There are appearances, on the one hand, one kind of thing, and there are these other things, these things in themselves. And we can't know these things, we can only know those things. I don't think that's actually the right way to read Kant. I think that when he says we can't know things in themselves, it's in some way more helpful to think of the in themselves as modifying the know rather than the things. In other words, when we talk about appearances and we talk about things in themselves, they're just the same things. It's just that we know those things as they appear to us. We don't know them as they are in themselves. There's nothing it would mean to know something except as it appears to us. So as I interpret Kant, the things that the things that appear to us and the things that exist in themselves are just the same things. Those are two different takes on the same things. Now, of course, Kant thought that some of the ways things appear to us are ways they cannot be in reality. For example, Kant thought he had an argument that space and time, by their nature, couldn't apply to reality. They could only apply to appearances. Mises never says anything like that. Mises never suggests that the way things appear to us is something that just couldn't be true in reality. He occasionally says things that make it sound like, well, maybe we don't know whether they apply to reality or not. But he wasn't that interested in that. I mean, Mises didn't have a general interest in epistemology. He was interested in epistemology to the extent that it was relevant to economics, but not that much beyond it, a little bit beyond it. I mean, not the way Kant was, just trying to understand it for its own sake. And so Mises just doesn't commit himself on some of those questions. But at any rate, Kant always thought of himself as defending the objectivity of knowledge. Now, you might think that maybe he's doing it in a somewhat Pickwickian way, since what objectivity turns out to be for him might not be quite what you thought objectivity was going to be. But at any rate, Kant wanted to reconcile objectivity with our experience being shaped and structured by our concepts, not to show that that somehow defeats objectivity. Sorry, Ayn Rand, but it's not what he meant. Which is not to say that Kant didn't make any mistakes, but... okay, we are done. Thank you.